Yo, yo, welcome to Crypto 101. This is Matthew Aaron. And today we have an interview with the CEO of SyncFab, Mr. Jeremy Goodwin. Now, Jeremy and I talked for over an hour. We condensed this down to under an hour, but we talked about all kinds of things. What is an IPO? What is an ICO? Should be regulated or shouldn't they be regulated? How he feels that the crypto world and blockchain is going to roll out in the future. And he talks about his company, SyncFab, how he's innovating the business already, but then he's going to step it up a notch and integrate manufacturing, supply chain in the blockchain. So this is very exciting. We've been going through these past weeks or months of learning about what is blockchain and different aspects of how blockchain is going to disrupt industries. And this is another one. This is more niche than we're used to. Procurement supply chain is something that I don't really know much about. I know there's probably a lot of you out there that do know quite a bit about supply chain. And I never thought about this. And he is building a token that's going to go ICO November to deal with these issues. It's just showing you that blockchain and the uses for blockchain is just endless. So I'll see you after the interview to wrap things up. And here is Jeremy Goodwin, CEO of SyncFab. P.S. You can find links to him, his companies, his Twitter, social media in the description below. Just to show you where the hell I come from, I get done with the 112. Check my rap from my hip when I have sex. Like this. Make you twist to the mist of a funky brain sound when it's pumped on the spliff and all that, the hi-hat. Go by that. Listen, look, oops, brother, where your eyes at? They on the floor.
I didn't realize you were in Taiwan yourself. That's pretty interesting. How long have you been out there?
I've been out here for only 10, 11 months.
That's a fair amount of time. I mean, you got the lay of the land.
Yeah, I was living in China for 12 years, mainland China.
I spent some time in China before myself, primarily Beijing.
Wait, yeah, what year was this?
First time I went there was 96.
Okay. My first time was 2004, and I was living there since 2004.
Those were some good times.
Those were some amazing times. Yeah. Have you been back since, lately?
I haven't been back since, like, say, 2012, I suppose.
Okay. So you still remember the real gritty Beijing.
And I prefer that type of grit as opposed to the current type of grit.
Yeah, exactly. You have to be an old China hat to be able to understand what that means, though. Like, the old grit to the new grit.
There were, like, no cars on the road. And I actually kind of preferred, you know, like, the raw brown Beijing, because it was just like a ground dirt as opposed to, you know, like a airborne soot dirt.
Right.
And, you know, that was before, like, the whole, you know, greenification of Beijing, which, you know, the green was nice and everything, but I mean, it was, like, obviously very superficial.
Right.
And, you know, the older buildings, the older structures,
yep.
The more kind of, you know, genuine, friendly demeanor of the people, as opposed to, you know, now, obviously, I mean, they're hyper educated, hyper wealthy, you know, super cosmopolitan, and, you know, they're not like New York in that sense of sophistication. It's like a different type, you know. I mean, they're very friendly people. I think they're more friendly than Shanghai, but the grit was more, you know, like the friends you make and just like getting out on the road and like pushing the old like Russian Lata, you know, car to like start up and get to the bars, as opposed to, like, you know, being, you know, sitting in the back of someone's, you know, Mercedes or whatever and being, yep. you know, kind of namelessly, you know, like shuttled somewhere.
The buses were something else. I don't know if you ever ridden on these, but they had those little mini buses. Like, they were like little converted vans with like sliding open doors, and they just stuff people in there like a cannoli, and people were falling out the doors, and sometimes you'd have to have the driver come out and fight some people.
Yeah. No, the bread box.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
No, those were great.
That's right. I forgot that Victor told me that you speak Chinese.
Yeah, I do.
So we can drop the mianbao che and all that stuff. That's okay.
Totally. Mei wenti.
How? So, Jeremy, man, it's good to have you on the line here. It's really amazing to talk to you. I heard a lot about you. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Can we just start off? Could you please just tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
That's like the easiest thing to do is talk about yourself. So I'll try and keep it like short and sweet.
No, bring it.
You know, I'm in California now in the Bay Area, and I look back fondly on my days in China. I first, as I was just sharing with you, I first went to China in like the mid 90s when China was like the 12th largest economy in the world. Now it's number two. So, you know, saw a lot of change there, and, you know, both look back fondly on the original Beijing with, you know, great fondness, while at the same time, you know, really just like being like mesmerized by the current change and the change that's happened all around the country. And, you know, at the same time, seeing a lot of the change that's taken place, you know, in the U.S. on like multi layers, many different levels, you know, cultural, economic, structural. And so myself, I grew up, you know, kind of traveling and being educated, you know, all around the planet. And so taking up an interest, you know, like in Chinese and having like an international perspective as an American just came as second nature to me. And so, you know, having spent a lot of time in the East and the Far East as a kid, I wanted to figure out how to, you know, kind of engage in a career in China, you know, using my Western, you know, kind of like commercial, you know, savvy, and figuring out, you know, how to like make, you know, mutually advantageous business deals. And at the same time, learn about, you know, Chinese culture and things. And the way that things are changing so quickly and so dramatically, you know, on both sides of the ocean, and how the world's getting smaller and technological advancement, you know, found myself after running a large-scale construction company that was listed on NASDAQ and a subsequent kind of like crisis of confidence in the public market, a shakeout that occurred, you know, really wanted to come back home and establish roots again, you know, see the family and figure out, you know, how I can, you know, use these technologies to benefit folks closer to home. But then, you know, it grew to become more a consideration about, okay, how do we localize production and raise people's consciousness and awareness about how production affects their immediate environment around them, because that's, you know, what started off is kind of like a sense of like patriotism or loyalty to home, you know, really became more like, okay, the planet is all our homes, and how can we use, you know, manufacturing technologies more responsibly to look after, you know, our kids after us and our grandkids and take better care of the planet.
That you just mentioned that you were in Beijing and you were working for a construction company that was listed on the NASDAQ. I've heard a rumor that you had a couple companies, or you were involved in a couple companies going IPO. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, since I went to China fairly early on, just in the context of, you know, China's economic boom, you know, I witnessed the growth of a lot of, you know, what are now just like tremendous, you know, Chinese institutions, conglomerates, whatnot. You know, one of them including Shagang Steel in Jiangsu province. I was first invited to visit them like in the late 90s when I was all of, you know, 25. And, you know, their iron foundry was just a remnant of the Cultural Revolution, a rusted out iron foundry. And there they were asking me, hey, you know, can you help us modernize our, you know, our plant so that we can start to, you know, supply this booming infrastructure demand that's taking place around the country. And, and you know, at the time, you know, I was so young and the foundry itself looked so, you know, unappealing that I looked at them and looked at myself and just kind of shake my head in disbelief. And I was like, you know, how can something possibly, you know, be done here? And that was really, you know, the miracle and the surprise, you know, that happened in China's economic growth. So, over the course of that time, from like the mid-90s to, you know, say the late 2000s, I came across many opportunities like that, everything from like the principal investment, private equity side, through to like, you know, advising growing companies, you know, how they can list. Mm-hmm. And so there were several companies that I worked with, the last of which was that construction company, which is probably the easiest for me to talk about because I ended up taking an operational role with them as well. You know, that company was involved in a lot of like prestigious infrastructure projects in China, including high-speed rail. They did laid the foundation for the first high-speed rail line from Beijing to Tianjin. They worked on the new U.S. embassy, the new French embassy, parts of the bird's nest in Beijing. So they were involved in a lot of, you know, infrastructure projects that were critical to the run-up to the Olympics. And obviously, those were extremely lucrative contracts, and they were viewed with very high regard by the government as, you know, developmental milestones in preparation to receive this international audience so that they could properly have their kind of coming out party, if you will.
Right.
And so this company, whose founder was previously the vice party secretary for Beijing Construction Company, which is the construction arm of the Beijing municipal government, you know, he kind of left and set up his own private company. And, you know, just in my normal dealings and workings, you know, with different Chinese groups, you know, learned of this opportunity to finance this company to grow and to go public. It was very interesting at the time because, you know, the laws and the regulations in China are so protective, you know, over Chinese assets. There's capital controls, there's protection of assets, there's restricted industries, there's, you know, the monitoring of information.
Right.
So, you know, an industry is critical as construction, you know, in China, you know, the thought of like going public in the U.S. was, you know, it's a real brain teaser. Like, how do you structure that? You know, how do you make that kind of opportunity, you know, accessible to like American investors?
Right.
You know, I saw that as a challenge. And obviously, it was a very exciting business at the time. I mean, right now, you know, people, they look at the infrastructure in China, they're kind of scratching their head, like, how did this all get financed? But
So could you tell us really quick, what is an IPO?
IPO stands for initial public offering, and it speaks to, you know, a company taking its equity, which is, you know, traditionally on paper, is basically, you know, shareholding in the company, and taking a portion of that and making it available for public sale to the general public to own equity in an enterprise.
Okay.
So an IPO, the initial public offering, it's really underlining the P in the IPO is like offering company shares to the public.
What is the difference between an ICO and an IPO? And you just mentioned there's a little bit of a problem going cross country, cross borders because of the laws and regulations. How does an ICO solve those problems? And is that a good thing?
That's a very interesting question because, you know, an IPO is a longstanding exercise. It's an industry with a lot of history. And so a lot of, you know, legal precedent in several jurisdictions, you know, around the world that are, you know, typically they're meant to protect, you know, retail investors, you know, from, you know, with proper disclosures about risks and, you know, what they're buying into, you know, according to different jurisdictions, you know, established precedent of law, rules and regulations. And then, of course, in countries like China and others, you know, there's the history is shorter. So those rules and regulations were, you know, kind of put together more recently with more of a limited reference, you know, track record. So that compared to an ICO, where you're transitioning, you know, from a traditional paper-based equity offering to a digital world blockchain-based cryptocurrency sale and distribution event to the general public. And because it's in the virtual space, it transcends, if you will, you know, traditional legal jurisdictions and certainly boundaries. Because you're not looking at a stock exchange that is restricted to a particular jurisdiction in Hong Kong or Shanghai or New York. You're either issuing an altcoin into the virtual space, or you're building your own blockchain with its own native currency that is, you know, potentially going to be traded on one of these crypto exchanges. And currently, with the exception of a couple, you know, superficial bans that were, you know, kind of impetuously imposed by some, you know, government regulators until they feel they can get a grip on, you know, understanding the industry, there is no real regulation at the moment.
Can you elaborate on superficial ban?
Well, superficial because it doesn't have much substance to it other than the context that it's just a ban.
Right.
So it's meant to just kind of put a freeze on all activity or as much activity as they state, so that they can take the time to go in and kind of research and understand the industry. But the nature of innovation and innovative technology when you try and put a ban or you put a freeze or a stop on innovation, it's not going to stop innovation. It may temporarily freeze things in your area that you have influence over, but it's certainly not going to stop things that are happening around the rest of the world.
Right.
And whether or not it's a good thing, it's certainly a good thing for technological innovation, for blockchain entrepreneurs, as well as for entrepreneurs who are looking for alternative means of financing and weren't getting the proper financing that they had for legitimate businesses through proper, you know, through traditional, you know, venture capital pathways, as well as those more, you know, remote or underrepresented or somehow disadvantaged, you know, entrepreneurs that, that didn't have access to growth capital through those traditional routes. So it's a good thing, and a very good thing from that regard.
So do you feel that with everything that's happening in the crypto world these days, there seems like to be a new ICO probably every hour coming out trying to get funding for X, Y, or Z project. It's very hard for the investor, the mom, the pop, or whoever to weed through all of these white papers, these histories and what have you to see what is legit. I think that's what you just said is legit. Do you think ICOs should be regulated?
In terms of regulation, I mean, that's a very complicated question only because, I mean, the way cryptocurrencies and blockchain is set up. So I'll try and seek out, you know, a comparable. It's somewhat of a comp, but not quite the same. You know, the U.S. Congress has been deliberating on regulating, you know, tax, sales tax in the internet space for quite a long time. And trying to figure out, you know, where does nexus occur, you know, in the web space, in the internet space, so that they can establish and deem, you know, like what tax jurisdiction do these, you know, e-commerce transactions, you know, fall under. Right. Particularly when, you know, you're setting up like, you know, an online, you know, e-commerce store and say, you know, the supplier in one state is not in your state or not in your country, but they're selling to someone who's in their same state or same country, but that's not yours, which is, you know, either where the website is hosted or where your business is based. You know, should Nexus be established there and should they be charged tax? So a question potentially, you know, is either simple or complex is that, you know, they've been struggling with for quite a long time. And should that be regulated? Well, I mean, that's really, who does that affect? I mean, it affects, you know, the government's pockets. You know, they'd certainly like to be able to, you know, tax that transaction so that they can, you know, expand their revenue base and potentially, you know, fund this either universal basic income or warheads. You know, hopefully it's universal basic income. Should they regulate ICOs and cryptocurrency offerings? Well, it seems like the greatest area that really is crying out or screaming out for regulation right now is precisely what you just pointed to, which is, you know, what are these potentially, you know, like abusive, you know, cryptocurrency offerings? You know, what is the way really to like screen these so that the general public that doesn't understand cryptocurrency, that doesn't understand blockchain, you know, that they can be protected from, you know, say participating in those at their own, you know, at their own hazard. Since you're in the virtual space, you know, like which regulatory body's, you know, responsibility is it to formulate, you know, that regulation, and where all you really have to establish jurisdiction are these IP addresses, you know, in that space. So would it be a good thing? It seems increasingly so, like it's needed for certain types. I mean, at the very least, there needs to be some type of governance, you know, protocol in the space, that ideally, you know, whether it's, you know, some type of procedure that screens or filters out, you know, cryptocurrency distribution events, you know, before they even occur, say through like an application through the Ethereum platform or some alternative blockchain. But then again, if you're building your own blockchain, you know, what then is the screen process? How is that supposed to take place? But albeit, you know, if you have the resources and the brain power to put together a whole new blockchain, that's going to have some value there in and of itself. So I don't know. It's a very controversial and complex question. Should the space be regulated? I mean, at the end of the day, it's about, you know, protecting the, you know, the less informed retail investors who they must have some idea, you know, really that they're taking a very risky investment. But at the same time, it's a shiny new space. Clearly, blockchain is here to stay. Cryptocurrencies are here to stay. Purchasers of you know, existing services or investors in security, hybrid, you know, cryptocurrencies are all trying to figure out, you know, which of those protocols, which of those currencies are still going to be here in a few years. And is that something that needs to be regulated, or is that something that just needs to like run its course?
That's a very interesting answer, and I really appreciate that. I guess one of the hardest things for people to do is let things run their course, especially if you see that there is this collateral damage kind of like spilling over along the way. People are losing money. There are complaints. There is outrage, and you know, cases brought up to the SEC and things like that. As people are, you know, I have damages. These people scam me. And now we can't find them with millions of dollars. I guess that happens with all businesses, but I think with ICOs, it's more public right now just because of the way the world's set up with internet and connectivity and things like that.
I mean, if I could for a minute, I mean, only because, you know, there's established rules and procedures, you know, for traditional equities and securities and investments that are ultimately, you know, they're meant to protect, you know, the small or the retail investor who doesn't have the resources or the sophistication, you know, financial acumen to go in and properly evaluate an investment opportunity, right? So that's why they have all those rules and procedures for auditing and providing financials and whatnot for securities investors. But with regards to, you know, buying into cryptocurrencies where there's, you know, the way it's structured, I mean, there is no... Well, depending how it's structured, there's not typically any equity participation. There's no financial projections attached to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, at best, you know, it's a judgment call. And I believe that people who are buying these, unless they're genuinely interested in the underlying service or product itself, which is what a utility token is meant to be representing, if they're buying into some other type of really arcane structured cryptocurrency on the basis of, you know, attempting to understand that, you know, they really are relying on their ability to do their own analysis, to do their own research, the integrity of the company or the business that's running the project. So like if they're misrepresenting information somehow, mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's something that necessarily should fall within the realm of regulation, but certainly, you know, I mean, that there are, you know, courts for that, for like civil suits and those types of things, right. Or like the Better Business Bureau, you know, for companies that are going out and making, you know, just flagrant misrepresentations.
Right. You know, to be perfectly honest, I'm kind of with you with this, that there should be something that falls within, like, say, the Ethereum network or blockchain, that they can get it approved or some kind of like process through a smart contract or a smart constitution, like through a blockchain governing body to kind of weed these guys out, because I'm personally for some sort of regulation, but I don't want it from a government, because that's going to make everything very complex and you're going to start getting to the same old systems, centralized, government overruled, control sort of thing. And the thing that blockchain and cryptocurrencies is doing is allowing a lot of individuals like myself that hasn't been involved in this kind of, you know, dealing, the ability to get in. But with this lack of oversight, there will be regulation, and I think that's inevitable because of the way that it is rolling out and a lot of money's to be made. Do you think that it is inevitable that governments will get involved?
Well, hey, look, I mean, there's so much activity taking place in the space right now. I mean, some of the most amazing statistics we're hearing is that the amount of capital being raised in the space has already, you know, dwarfed traditional venture capital investment by a number of magnitude. I don't know what the exact number is. It's right. Like, you know, 5 times or 10 times. And so, you know, numbers so shocking as those, you know, they're capturing the attention of venture capitalists themselves and certainly the government regulators. If anything, you know, because of capital flow movements, you know, who's using this capital, you know, is it peace, you know, peace seeking, you know, entrepreneurs who are just looking at commercial transaction, or is it, you know, money launderers, gangsters, and those things, which obviously, you know, that's keeping the peace. But at the same time, of course, you know, they want their tax, they want their revenue. You know, it's in government's nature, you know, to want to control things.
Right.
So, you know, the industry really is in its infancy right now. You know, I was reading something interesting just this morning, and they were saying that a lot of people are looking at the industry now and saying that, okay, you know, token sales and cryptocurrency is in a bubble right now, you know, kind of like, you know, when the internet bubble was occurring in 2000, you know, that reference is being used a lot. And it's just interesting in the context that, you know, even though they're saying it's in a bubble, it's like we tend to overestimate the current impact of new technologies and underestimate the long-term impact of those technologies. So irrelevant of whether or not, you know, you think it's a bubble, the advent of the internet, for example, you know, it's generated, you know, like multiple trillions of dollars in value, you know, over the past 20 years to the industry.
Right.
It's the total size of the blockchain industry right now is still only $150 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, whether or not it's in a bubble, it's very subjective.
Switching gears a little bit, because I really want to talk about, I love picking your brain a little bit about ICOs and IPOs. You're an old China hat like I am. However, I really want to switch gears to SyncFab. You're the CEO of SyncFab. You're going to be evolving SyncFab to work with the blockchain. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, so my current passion is, you know, is SyncFab and looking at, so we're in an interesting model where we're taking, you know, like advanced manufacturing technologies and embedding them in like public-private partnerships, you know, combining missions of, you know, a private for-profit company with like the economic development of governments who you know, are supposed to care about citizenry, right? And so obviously the manufacturing industry in the U.S. as well as other parts of the world, you know, has been experiencing transitions, these, you know, painful transitions. And like in the U.S. we have Rust Belt, for example, who, you know, potentially had like, you know, voice in like the recent election. So, you know, it's kind of like that theme, that evolving theme of like technology haves versus technology have nots.
Mm-hmm.
So really using advanced manufacturing technology to figure out and blockchain to figure out how can we speak to, you know, those have nots.
Mm-hmm.
And so one area, so we've been working on this, you know, advanced manufacturing meets data optimized manufacturing processes meets, you know, computer aided manufacturing ecosystem model for several years now in partnership with the city of San Francisco and the city of San Leandro, which is in the East Bay, which is where all the affordable real estate and the manufacturing takes place to fuel, you know, to support and supply the hardware innovation ecosystem in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is where Tesla is headquartered, which
right.
is where of international, you know, Chinese invested electric vehicle companies are set up, like NIO, like Lucid Vehicles, two of Lusha Media's, you know, Mr. Jiayue Ting's owned, you know, multi-billion dollar capitalized electric vehicle companies. So there's a huge demand for manufacturing precision parts and components that go into these, you know, hardware companies, be it drones, medical devices, electric vehicles, or just hardware in general. That being said, building this machining capacity network where we can read the utilization rates of machining capability, where even a self-contained operation like Tesla still has to outsource because they can't manufacture everything under one roof, that there's a real tremendous utility to them and to the supply chain to be able to read, you know, in time where that production capacity is available. And in mapping that availability by process, by certification, by location, by budget, by capabilities, and then matching it to real-time evolving, you know, demand requirements that are also location-based, we had to figure out what their specific requirements were. Now, these requirements, which are channeled through our data aggregation so that we can optimize those processes, fit perfectly. We call that smart manufacturing, data-driven manufacturing, fit perfectly with the smart contracts that are embedded in blockchain. Mm-hmm. So here we have this marriage of supply chain meets blockchain. Mm-hmm. And we have been, you know, enthralled with the potential and the possibilities, you know, for a couple years now. But when you think about, you know, the impact that blockchain will have, you know, or even certainly when you're thinking about building it out, you know, it can be very overwhelming. So we were a bit intimidated at first, you know. We were, you know, already really excited about our existing product, but we're like, okay, you know, how are we gonna do this? You know, it takes a lot of brain power, it takes a lot of manpower, it takes a lot of time and concentration and resources, you know, especially in the Bay Area where housing is just so expensive. So that being said, you know, voila, here comes, you know, Vitalik with this just amazing creation of, you know, Ethereum as you know, an upgrade on the Bitcoin, you know, blockchain, and with a built-in incentive structure, you know, to help build out this blockchain, which is the gold standard for smart contracts, and thereby, you know, providing a means of, you know, self-funding these projects so that you can build blockchains, you know, specifically, you know, specific to certain industries.
How do you feel that blockchains would work with your industry? Could you just take us through like a step-by-step process of what are they doing now to secure supplies or products, and then how would blockchain and smart contracts do it differently?
I'm just going to say how they're doing it right now when they're not using SyncFat. So what's amazing is, you know, here we are, you know, it's 2017, and when these supply chain buyers, you know, are sourcing, you know, production capacity for anything from precision parts, you know, casting or injection molding, you know, like precision, you know, parts for their finished goods, they're making tons of phone calls. They're sending lots of emails. Mm-hmm. They're signing tons of NDAs. Yeah. They're driving cars around a lot, and they're sending out, you know, armies of people, you know, all around the place, you know, right, on airplanes and cars, you know, trains, planes, and automobiles, you know, in 2017, you know, so you've got this image of, you know, 1999 or 19, you know, even 1995, 1996, when I was in Beijing, like in present day 2017, you know, San Francisco Bay, California, that's meant to be like the innovation center of the globe, right? But people are still sending emails and making phone calls, you know, when they're not using SyncFab to procure, you know, their precision part production there. So what we did is we built, you know, as cliche as it is, the simplest comparison I can make is, you know, an Uber model where we call it the web 2.0, where now we have the blockchain reference of 3.0. We call it the web 2.0, mm-hmm, of precision parts procurement, where they'll come to us, they'll submit their digital design assets, we'll agree to kind of like general intellectual property protection terms, and then we'll read, you know, the precision specifications of those parts, and then match them by process, by material, to available capacity that we have logged on our capacity network.
And all of this conversation would be within the blockchain.
So currently this is within the web 2.0 environment. So there's no emails, there's no interaction, there's no calls. It's all within our, you know, kind of like beautifully designed UX, UI of the web.
Right.
The web 2.0. And where we design that all around, you know, their specific requirements in terms of, you know, net days payable, you know, ISO certification requirements, turnaround time, urgency, you know, 1 week, right, to several days, et cetera, et cetera. It can get really complicated with these types of orders. So currently it's in this kind of, you know, web 2.0, you know, beautiful UI, UX, intuitive design, you know, kind of order flow. So the reference that I make is, you know, in the 2.0 currently, we reference artificial intelligence and data analysis and matching as a kind of, you know, cyborg model or the, mm-hmm, RoboCop model, or what they call, you know, Amazon has this thing called Mechanical Turk, where they're saying they're doing a whole bunch of, you know, data analysis, but it's actually, you know, just a bunch of interns, you know, sitting in cubicles, you know, crunching spreadsheets and making pivot, you know, Excel pivot tables.
That's hilarious.
They call it Mechanical Turk because it's like, you know, you're interfacing with the web with, you know, human beings in cubicles that are just crunching pivot tables.
Huh.
And that's what they call, you know, artificial intelligence now. I mean, there are some algorithms, you know, out there that are, you know, reading and interpreting, you know, images and those kind of things. But so what I make the reference of the Web 2.0 is where we've predefined these conditions, or we allow the buyer to define their conditions, and then we've predefined the existing conditions that we've cataloged for the available machining capacity. Mm-hmm. You know, still like a heavy element of Mechanical Turk, you know, kind of overlap therein, right, where, you know, there's like manual facilitation going on, you know, to match them and to monitor the flow and to make sure that quality control is being done properly, you know, all the production is being done on time, et cetera, et cetera. Initially, when we generate and distribute the token, the idea behind the token is that it's going to offer an incentive where an incentive doesn't exist. And I'll get to the smart contracts in a second.
Okay.
But I just want to follow it in terms of, you know, like the timeline. So the token will be generated and distributed, the MFG token, and it will offer an incentive where an incentive doesn't currently exist, which is that the machining shops that are bidding on the jobs, that are responding to the RFQs, are doing so on the basis that they think that there's going to be a good amount of money, you know, coming from one of these contracts or some kind of steady business flow, because they're taking anywhere from half an hour to half a day, you know, to quote these jobs based on the complexity of the job.
Right.
And they do that for free. And it's basically just, you know, time out of their day because we expect them to do that. You know, so accordingly, you know, that will provoke, you know, behaviors where that are not, you know, ideal or optimal, you know, for the smaller, medium sized inventors who are kind of, you know, the true innovators now. Mm-hmm. I mean, because Apple is, yeah, I mean, you know, they're kind of like on a, you know, an automatic pathway to innovating. But a lot of the real innovation is still coming from, you know, those hungry, you know, really creative, really inventive, you know, entrepreneurs, the small, medium-sized guys. And they can't get the manufacturers to respond to them if it was to save their life. So, you know, how do we help the manufacturers get paid for what we take them for granted for? And how do we help this, you know, the innovators get more access to what we are starting to see as kind of decentralized, you know, economy of scale, production scale. And so creating this incentive where, you know, in the current environment in the US and increasingly around the globe of this like disenchantment around, you know, those that are being left behind by the technology, you know, kind of like that unwanted relative that, you know, we want to rely on, but we don't want to see all the time, the blue collar worker, you know, the working class, just keep them in the basement and we want them there when we need them to fix the car. But, you know, don't show yourself. How do we keep them incentivized? I'm just saying, you know, like we take them for granted. And they finally got fed up and voted, you know, this guy, you know, in the office. So obviously, you know, we need to do something. So we create this we create this token to pay them for what we're currently taking them for granted for, and we create a whole new economy on top of the existing economy, and we create more responsiveness to where a lot of that true innovation is really coming from now in the hardware space, which is small, medium size.
Let me see if I got this and break this down. I, Matthew Aaron, could be sitting at home, and everybody's just doing their job. They're doing their job with you know, procuring supplies for a different project, this, that, the other things, ball bearings, forgings over here, you know, some kind of, you know, electrical whatever for a car over there. And they're making these bids and putting in these, you know, making these big contracts for whatever company, Tesla, General Motors, what have you. These are going to be ran on a token, and I can invest in the profitability of these contracts.
So what it is these tokens will basically buy into the production network that these suppliers are supplying to the supply chain buyers at the likes of someone, say, like a Tesla, down to, you know, the smaller hardware inventors. So the token will basically be, you know, pre-selling production capacity access to this network. It's not buying into the profitability of those enterprises, but it is buying into what we view as what will be a growing protocol that's going to map and follow the the supply chain buyer's requirements configured specifically for production requirements in an increasingly expanding supply chain built on the blockchain.
So you're buying into the supply chain network.
You're buying into the supply chain network into a token that's going to unlock smart contracts that we want and we believe will become a standard for the industry.
How do you think that this would disrupt the industry?
This will disrupt the industry on so many levels. You know, one is going to be, you know, just-in-time production or just-in-time inventory has been on a theoretical basis that, you know, it's still very manual. It hasn't even been Mechanical Turk. You know, when we push that through the Mechanical Turk, the 2.0, you know, iteration through to a truly implemented and fully functioning blockchain-enabled, you know, smart contract ecosystem, mm-hmm. you know, just-in-time production becomes a reality. So the implications that's going to have for mass custom production, you know, truly customized production, you know, for the individual consumer, as well as like, you know, custom production runs is going to be tremendous because it will be done on economies of scale, meeting economies of scale requirements so that enterprises large and small, you know, can do this according to their design, their brand for their consumer base. So it's going to disrupt the industry in terms of achieving a truly responsive production line to match an increasingly, you know, over responsive consumer, you know, side. You know, very simply, what SyncFab is doing is issuing, you know, a cryptocurrency to incentivize, you know, blue collar working class manufacturers to get paid for something that we generally have taken them for granted for, which is, you know, quoting jobs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, incentivizing them to be more responsive to the small and medium sized hardware innovators and inventors.
Who do you think is the one person in the crypto space that you look up to or you think is important or influential?
That's a really good question. I mean, of course, we had the creator, the anonymous creator of, you know, the Bitcoin blockchain, Satoshi Nakamoto, who was just, I mean, he was an Einstein in his own right, just conceiving of this amazing, you know, protocol to serve as a counterweight to the financial crisis, an alternative, you know, financial system, if you will, independent of central banks. And so I just think that type of forward thinking is incredible. But at the same time, you know, Vitalik Buterin's, you know, notion to improve upon what Satoshi created, while at the same time, you know, offering this additional level of incentive to new blockchain entrepreneurs to build on his blockchain, I think is mind blowing. But I would have to say it's Satoshi because, I mean, he was the first one to start this revolution.
And what is your advice to the 101 person, somebody that's listened to, say, if this was the first podcast they listened to in the crypto space, what would your advice be to them?
From what standpoint? Like, they're just starting to learn about the space and they want to learn more, right?
They want to learn more. They don't know if this is like a, because I guess in this space, a lot of people don't know what the future is. Some people think there's a lot of FUD, there's a lot of hype. It's a bubble. It's a Ponzi scheme. Bitcoin is blockchain's coming out and everybody's making big claims about blockchain in the future. What would you tell to these people if they're just coming in, they just don't know what to think?
Well, so there's a lot of stigma behind the blockchain space right now, so that when people first come into it, I've found that a lot of people tend to have a very extreme reaction. It's either a very extreme rejection or a very extreme, you know, kind of embracing it. And you know, so those who are rejecting it are making, you know, like very, you know, just remarkable, you know, pronouncements that, you know, blockchain is just all a scam. It's all a Ponzi scheme. And then on the other side, you know, you've got like the average Joes who are like, you know, selling their homes, you know, selling their cars, selling everything they own so that, you know, they could be properly positioned, you know, when Bitcoin goes through the roof, which is already happening, you know, right as we're speaking. I mean, I would encourage them to, you know, just kind of step back, you know, take a breath. You know, it's generally understood and accepted that blockchain is here to stay. So if you're having an extreme reaction of rejection, you know, check yourself, you know, and also, you know, just be more cautious if you're, you know, looking to, you know, diversify your portfolio. Don't put everything into one place. Don't put everything into crypto. You know, beyond that, if you're thinking about investing or buying into a utility token in the crypto space, make sure you really understand the underlying product, the background of the individual team, and you understand, you know, what the currency is going to be used for. You know, do your due diligence. And then otherwise, if it's just general education, you know, there's a lot of, you know, podcasts like your podcast. There's, you know, I would avoid just like the general media news clips and tidbits, and really find an educational, you know, blockchain thread. I mean, there's the general ones, you know, like Cointelegraph, and then there are other more educational, you know, sources as well. So I would stay away from the general media stuff and look for, you know, truly informational and educational, you know, reading sources on blockchain, and learn about blockchain before you start focusing on just the cryptocurrencies themselves.
Are you holding any currencies right now or crypto?
Yeah, I mean, I hold Ether. I didn't really get in early enough to do the Bitcoin, but I do own Ether.
Final question of the day, and I always think it's the most important question. What three songs would you like with your interview?
Oh, what three songs? is this being included in the in the podcast, or is this kind of
absolutely,
huh? My colleague asked me this the other day, and you know, I did a little search, because a couple of things that popped up initially was, you know, some of those like those moving songs, you know, like the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, there's like you know, Bon Jovi, It's My Life, and you know, I made a reference to that timeless, you know, you know, soundtrack from Rocky, you know, like the my 20 something, you know, colleague, he's like, dude, you're really showing your age. I was like, all right, fine.
We can make your songs and put them in there.
All right. I mean, okay. Sounds good.
It's a thing I have with the interview. Every person that I interview gives us their music choices for their interview. And I really like it, because a lot of people like really connect with the person on a different level than just, you know, blockchain, crypto. And then they go, I like that guy's style, or 80s or 90s or whatever. Lead developer of Vertcoin. He loves underground music, but he picked 80s music for his, and he's a 20-year-old.
Yeah.
And people emailed me all the time, was like, that was the best. So I really like the connection. It's my Jeremy, thank you very much for talking to us today. But before we go, I'm pretty sure SyncFab is having an ICO coming up pretty soon. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, of course. So we call it a token sale here in the U.S. because of evolving regulations. But we're selling a utility token that ultimately gives the buyer access to our production capacity network. So it's what we're doing at SyncFab is blockchain from manufacturing supply chain, giving you access to localized precision part production from clean manufacturers. And what we're selling is the MFG token to incentivize the manufacturing working class to be more responsive to small and medium-sized hardware innovators. So, you know, tap into the inventor in you to support traditional manufacturers to revolutionize the industry and embrace blockchain. November 15th, we've got our pre-sale, and registration is currently live. So please get on there so that we can start, you know, running through your information and make sure that, you know, you're all up to date on our developments as they're occurring. And so we can make sure, you know, that you're eligible, and so that we can make sure that we have a proper allocation, you know, set aside for you. Join our Telegram channel so that you can ask all the questions you want. And, you know, we have a lot of fun in there, too.
Right on, Jeremy. thank you again for coming on the show, and we hope to see you in a successful launch of the ICO.
Thanks, man. This has been fun.
Jeremy, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Hold on. Let me turn this off, and then we'll just have a conversation really quick.
Okay, cool.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Crypto 101. As usual, please head over to iTunes and rate us. Leave us a comment. It really helps us move us up the ranks. It really helps us be exposed, and we are getting more exposure. So I want to say thank you very much to the listeners, to people who are writing us on Twitter, crypto_101, people that are sending me emails, crypto.101@outlook.com, people that are hitting us up on Instagram at crypto_101, and anybody else that just goes and finds us at Crypto 101 on any of the other platforms. We really appreciate you getting involved, reaching out to us, and thank you very much for listening to this episode of Crypto 101. Finally, before we leave, the songs today, of course, picked by Jeremy, was Redman, Time for Some Action, Back to the 80s, Sync Wave and Retro Music Mix, and Bon Jovi, It's My Life. Thank you very much, Matthew Aaron with Crypto 101.